Case for argument, Ben Slimani versus Gonzalez, Mr. Mwangi.
Thank you, Judge Posner, Judge Ripple, Judge Rovner. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Godfrey Mwangi, representing the petitioner in this case. Our case is relatively simple. We have appealed a decision of the Board of Immigration Appeals, which affirmed the IJ's order that Mr. Ben Slimani be deported for having overstayed his visa.
I was puzzled why you didn't raise an ineffective assistance claim. The lawyer who represented Ben Slimani before the immigration judge, why didn't he just file another copy?
Your Honor, I did
judge
not...
Judge says, I want a copy. It's kind of a ridiculous request because the government has the copy. But nevertheless, the judge tells you to do something that you can do quite painlessly without sacrificing any rights or anything. Just Xerox something you've already submitted. Why not do that?
Your Honor, what would the reason be for
what the lawyer did?
Your Honor, because the lawyer did not have the application. The government had it.
What do you mean, didn't have a copy?
I don't believe he did, at least not according to the information that I have.
Well, why didn't he tell the immigration judge he didn't have a copy, instead of saying he wasn't required to submit it?
I don't know the answer to that question,
Your Honor.
Well,
but isn't that ridiculous? I mean, if you don't have the copy, you tell the judge, I don't have the copy. You don't tell the judge that I don't... There's no requirement that I submit it, so then the judge just gets angry with you.
Your Honor, I will concede that, but I think it's more ridiculous that the government, which had it...
No, I agree. That's ridiculous,
counsel,
too. Right?
Yeah. Was there any misapprehension on the part of your client as to whether he would have to pay a second fee in order to present that application to the IJ, having already paid the fee to the INS?
The IJ actually required that another fee be paid because the IJ specifically ordered counsel that he had to present evidence when he presented the new I-485 that he had actually feed it in again. And that's a term of art used in immigration court, meaning you've paid a fee to the INS and have proof that the fee has been paid.
If I may follow up on that, that does that necessarily mean pay the fee again, or simply evidence that you did pay the fee?
Your Honor, my sense of that would be that the IJ was requiring a new fee because already in front of the IJ was the fee receipt from the initial filing, and the IJ was telling counsel...
I'm sorry, is that what you said?
A fee receipt dated January 15 was already in front of the IJ. The IJ's order to counsel was, go pay the fee and bring me proof that you've paid the fee when you file the new application. And it's ridiculous to me, and I believe, in fairness, the government should have handed that application over. They argue that jurisdiction ceased when proceedings in front of the IJ commenced, but they've never explained what happened to the I-485 they were holding on to. They had it. They had the money for it. They've never denied it. They've never approved it. They just hold on to it.
Mr. Mwangi, forgive me, but the Attorney General argues that you failed, that you failed to exhaust your administrative remedies prior to raising your claim up here. And I am referring, of course, to what we're talking about, to the claim that the IJ unfairly required Mr. Ben-Sulaim to submit a second application and a second fee. Where did you raise that issue in the proceedings below? Or where was it raised in the proceedings below?
Your Honor, for me to be required to raise it, there has to be a clear requirement that Mr. Ben-Sulaim file the I-485 before the IJ. The IJ bases the order that he file the I-485 on matter of Garcia. If you read matter of Garcia, separating the headnotes from the actual opinion, there isn't a requirement to file a 485 with the IJ. Now, over time, this is an opinion from 1978. Garcia has been interpreted by other opinions, and it has now a legacy which is said to include the directive to file a 485 with the IJ. Now, I don't pretend to be an expert on these issues, but I've read Garcia, and Garcia can be interpreted to include the directive to file a 485 with the IJ if you read the headnotes together with the opinion. Now, I never raised that issue because my reading of Garcia does not include the directive to file a 485 with the IJ. That directive is not in Garcia. What it says is if an I-130 and an I-485 have been submitted, it does not say who has to submit them. And this is why I argue, why doesn't the person who's holding the evidence produce it? They argue that we are a different agency. Well, they're the same agency because the proceedings begin while they're still the INS on January 24th when they file the NTA with the IJ. They're still the INS. The INS ceases to exist on March 1st of 2003. On February the 25th, when the first hearing is held, they are still the INS. And I have received recently from the same agency a bag and baggage order that Ben-Sulaim appear on October 18 to be deported, which has on it Immigration and Naturalization Service. They say...
Well, they're economizing on their stationery.
And so how can they say...
Use the old stationery, and they charge the double fee, so they're reducing the federal deficit.
Well, that may shorten the period within which we are going to break even, but they cannot argue we are not INS, we don't have it in our file. Generally, the rule is the person with the evidence should produce it.
There was a statement in one by the IJ at one point in the record to the effect that all the burden on this case is going to rest on me, the implication being that whoever's supposed to have acted on the application that was filed with the INS, if they don't act on that, I've got a burden here that I can't meet. What was he talking about?
The IJ is talking about a decisional risk. Now, my interpretation of that is Washington was putting pressure at that time on IJs to close cases, get people out of the country who've been ordered deported. And the IJ understandably was feeling the pressure, and he doesn't want to continue a case indefinitely and have to explain why this case is on the docket. And so he's saying, I don't have to shoulder the decision of risk if you, INS, are refusing to tell me whether you're going to view this marriage as a bona fide marriage. INS was standing in front of him and saying, we're going to investigate the marriage because it occurred very close to proceedings beginning. Well, first of all, this is not a marriage entered into during proceedings. It's clearly outside proceedings. Proceedings began January 24th, 2003. The marriage was entered into December 27, 2002. They say they're investigating the bona fides. They go to the house of these two people over there on April the 22nd of 2003. On May 27, 2003, they still say, we know nothing about the bona fides.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mawal. Your time has expired. Ms. Ferrier?
May it please the court, my name is Cindy Ferrier, and I'll be representing the Attorney General in this matter.
You know, the IJ seems to have refused the continuance because it was under the mistaken impression that no I-465 had been filed. And it had been filed. And in fact, Ben Slamin Main's attorney had informed the IJ of that fact on February 25th, 2003. What I'm wondering is why should Mr. Ben Slamin be penalized for the failure of the Department of Homeland Security, or INS, to keep the record straight? In other words, who bears the burden of making sure that properly filed documents find their way into the administrative process? This just seems so unfair to me.
I believe that the immigration judge did understand that the I-485 had been filed with INS. I think that he did understand that. What he was asking for was that a copy of it, or that a new 485 be filed with him so that he could determine the prima facie eligibility himself.
So why didn't DHS give him a copy?
It's clear from the record that the judge was frustrated with DHS for not providing him with information, and DHS indicated, former INS at that point, that they weren't clear as to what was going on with the...
Well, I don't understand. You ask, he files the thing, the DHS has a copy, it loses the copy. So you're going to deport a person?
Oh, I don't think DHS...
Pardon, you didn't lose the copy. You have the copy?
What is happening is that DHS...
You have the copy.
INS, at that point, there was still a services branch and an enforcement branch. They weren't so expressly delineated as they are now. But at that point, he filed an application for adjustment and the visa petition with the services branch. They were adjudicating, and they are responsible for adjudicating the visa petition. That is a different file than what was before the enforcement or the trial attorney, I guess. The trial attorney's file.
What do you
file.
Mean, different files? Different information?
Different information. He, as is noted in the record, the same day that he filed, or that it was stamped as filed, the visa petition and the application for adjustment, the NTA, the notice to appear, was issued against him. So it appears from statements in the record that there were actually two separate alien registration numbers for the petitioner. There was some confusion. I think that the way it's not ever expressly described in the record, but I believe what had happened.
Well, if there's confusion to which DHS obviously has contributed, why do you want to deport the person? Why don't you just get this silly form filed, and then you can, and then the DHS, the immigration judge, BIA, can look at the documents and see whether this is a bona fide marriage or not.
And I think that that's what the judge was trying to do. He is quite frustrated, you can tell at the last hearing, with DHS because they didn't get him the information.
Yes, but if you're frustrated with DHS, why do you take it out against the alien?
But he allows the alien the opportunity because he said he sees that DHS is not providing it.
But the alien has already filed the thing. thing, and you have it. So why don't you just give
but
it to
the judge? Doesn't have it. I guess that's the only point.
Why don't
point.
You give it to the immigration? Are you the, you know, this, the
right.
guy, the department?
Why doesn't
you give
DHS?
It to him?
It's
why
clear.
Do they force you to come here and appeal something like this?
Because
I really don't get it.
Do you have any idea of what we are doing to these appeals?
What?
Does the Justice Department have any idea of what is happening to your cases in this court?
I believe that they are aware. Yes, we are trying.
There's a complete breakdown of this immigration adjudication business.
This is so cruel to send a lovely human being like you in here to be the messenger of such madness, such nonsense. It's cruel.
Well, the point that I feel comfortable in defending is the immigration judge's exercise of discretion to not continue a case where an application which he requested to be filed was not filed. This court has said in Castaneda Suarez that it is a permissible basis to deny a continuance if an application has not been filed by the date set. In this case, the immigration judge said, I will give you 2 months to submit the application to me. If you do that, then I will consider your case. And he made it quite clear the petitioner never objected to that. So then when he appears at the next hearing, the immigration judge says, well, where is your application? He says, well, I don't think I can file it, so I haven't filed it. That is where the immigration judge says, well, I don't have any applications then in front of me. I don't have anything. There's nothing for me to adjudicate. Therefore, I don't have a reason to continue the case. And that's what is at issue here. The issue regarding whether he could afford to pay for it or not was never raised before the immigration judge. It's not true that the immigration
judge
had
knew that these forms had been filed.
I believe that he knew, but there was no evidence in the record. Petitioner's counsel
if he
stated
knew they
that
had been filed. Why is he requiring another filing?
The form itself, the I-485, contains on it very valuable information from which the judge could just look at to determine his prima facie eligibility.
So since it's been filed and the government has it, why doesn't he say to the government, you have to give me copies of this form?
The immigration judge allowed the... I understand your frustration, and it's true that the forms were not submitted by DHS. That is why he allowed the opportunity to petitioner
There's
to submit.
There's no why there. Why didn't he insist that they be submitted?
Well, he didn't.
That's so crazy. You filed something, and the government has it. I thought you were going to say the government had lost it.
I do not know. I have information that they don't.
The government said to the IJ, look, we're very sorry. We lost it. We'll give this fellow, $250 or something, so he can file a new one because we lost, it's our fault. Could have said that to the immigration.
I don't believe that they lost it. I believe that they...
Where is it?
It has not yet been adjudicated.
Well, if they haven't lost it, why didn't the immigration judge say, well, you haven't lost it, you have it, so would you please produce it?
Well, he gave them 90 days to do that. Originally, they didn't do it.
Look, if you give someone 90, if you say to the government, you have 90 days to produce, and they come back and say, well, we haven't lost it, but we can't find it. We're a completely dysfunctional, disorganized agency. What do you expect? You wouldn't think he would then take it out on the alien.
But he was allowing them the opportunity to file it. When it wasn't filed, he had no information regarding the petitioner's application for adjustment. Petitioner cites that the receipt for the 485 and I-30 were submitted into evidence. They were after the immigration judge made his decision. And then, at that point, he submitted the adjustment application and the receipt for the visa petition, what the judge had asked for. However, it was filed with a motion to reconsider, but before the judge could rule on the motion to reconsider and perhaps consider that adjustment application and whether to continue the hearings longer or reopen and continue the hearings, the petitioner filed the appeal with the board. Therefore, the immigration judge could not reconsider.
Oh, you mean the forms have been filed?
They were filed with the immigration judge
after. Have they been filed? Have they been filed?
Well, no.
That's a yes or no.
Well, they were filed, but because
this is becoming more preposterous.
No, they were. I'm sorry. They were filed after the immigration judge made his decision.
Have they been filed?
They were submitted to the immigration.
So where are they now?
I'm sorry. There is a copy of them in the record. I don't mean to.
Where are these forms?
There are a copy of the forms in the record that were submitted with
the
motion
new
to
forms.
Reconsider.
So
No. They're a copy of what the immigration judge was asking for.
So what he asked for was eventually submitted.
Correct.
And it exists somewhere. Hasn't been lost yet.
It's in the record.
It's in the record. Okay. Now, what remedy does Ben Slimane now have, now that the forms have been found, the copies, and now they're before him? What remedies, if any, does Ben Slimane now have?
Those forms were submitted with the motion to reconsider.
Answer my question.
What
remedies does he have, if any,
once the visa petition is...
You're not answering my question.
What remedies
does he have now? Does he have any remedies or no remedies?
If the visa petition is approved, then he could potentially approach DHS for a motion to reopen and submit that to the Board of Immigration Appeals.
Now, what's this if clause in what you said?
The visa petition, this is the whole issue in this case, or the problem here. The visa petition there's two forms. The visa petition, which is the I-130 form, must be approved by...
So what's the status of
INS?
That I-30 form?
That is still pending.
Now, then how do we factor in the bag and baggage letter for October 18th? Is that in abeyance? Can we be sure that Mr. Ben Slimane won't be put on a plane?
You know, I wasn't aware that that had been issued, but and I'm not certain whether this court has issued a stay in the case. But if the court has issued a stay, if petitioner has filed...
Well, would you oppose a stay?
It's up to me. No, I wouldn't oppose a stay at this point. So...
The INS... or deal, whatever it is now, must approve that visa before the IJ can act. Am I correct?
Exactly.
And then the IJ takes that into consideration in determining the adjustment of status.
Yes.
What is your take on this language in the record where the IJ talks about this burden being placed on him by the inaction of the Department of Homeland Security? What's his problem?
I believe that Petitioner's Counsel accurately stated that it is pressure, not necessarily pressure, but not wanting to have something sit on his docket, which was what he would have to do until the visa petition is decided for a period of up to 2 years.
Why doesn't he want it sitting on his docket?
Because there was the potential that it could be for up to 2 years, and based upon the fact that the marriage wasn't entered into at a close time to the proceedings, not after proceedings, but a close time, that he was concerned. He just wanted to get some feel from DHS as to whether they felt that the visa petition would be approved. And just to make clear, the application and the copy of the visa petition, again, the IJ couldn't act on the application, grant it, without the approval from DHS. But those copies that are in the record were filed with a motion to reconsider, but the judge did not have the opportunity to rule on that, and because the appeal had been filed with the board, and he no longer had jurisdiction over the motion to reconsider. So technically, although those are in the record, they were never properly submitted for the board or for the IJ's consideration.
Okay, but just to make clear I understand this tangled absurdity, if he gets a favorable ruling on this visa petition, he can then ask for reconsideration?
He would need to ask DHS. Well, he wouldn't have to, but the best way is to ask for DHS to join in a motion to reopen. And at that, it would be covered under matter of Velarde, which is a board decision modifying matter of Garcia. And at that point, he can ask that the case be reopened based upon now this visa petition and this, excuse me, adjustment application.
So there would be jurisdiction to reopen?
With the Board of Immigration Appeals. But again, the motion would be untimely, so it would be something that DHS would need to join into.
What do you mean, would need to join?
Yeah. They would just not oppose. That would be what they would need to do.
So they wouldn't. You're saying they would not oppose.
I'm not saying. I can't say for certain what they would do, but I would, if they do not oppose, if the marriage is bona fide and there is no other reason, which would detract from the adjustment application, then they could choose not to oppose, and then therefore the motion would be reopened.
Now, is all of this in abeyance while this appeal goes on?
There is actually nothing pending right now. There is nothing pending with the board. The visa petition is still with DHS to adjudicate.
Is everything in abeyance while this goes forward?
The visa petition,
the
I believe that they are still, DHS still would act upon the visa petition, just what, determining whether they would grant it or not, but there hasn't been a decision on that, so I can't tell you that.
Then how do we know what they're doing over there when we're trying to decide this and all the facts may be changing?
Are you referring to their actual removal?
I'm referring to anything.
Well, there's nothing pending before the Board of Immigration Appeals and the Immigration Court right now. The case has a final order of removal. That is where he stands. As far as the adjustment application that was submitted to in 2003, the visa petition, the I-130 form, which is something that the I-130 form specifically DHS has to adjudicate, they still may adjudicate that, and they are still in the process of adjudicating that.
Even while how would we ever know this?
Well, presumably, petitioner would do what I've mentioned to you, is that if it's granted, move to reopen his immigration case.
No, how would we know?
Well, I could inform you if it's actually granted.
Can we be assured of that?
Sure.
You see, Ms. Ferrier, you probably know nothing of this, but we have actually had cases where we have entered stays, and individuals have been sent to, an individual, for instance, was sent to Norway, even though there was a stay. In other words, where the Attorney General paid no attention to the fact that the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit had said, no, you can't send this person back. And they knew that we had said, you can't send this person back. They just do. And then that's it. So we never want to see that happen again.
Well, as I've said, I am not certain that there is a stay in this case. Perhaps petitioner's counsel can tell you. But if there is a stay, then I will make certain that DHS is aware that the stay is in place and that the bag and baggage letter, should not be acted upon. However, if there is no stay filed for or in effect at this point, then there is a final order of removal against the petitioner at this point. So petitioner's counsel would need to move the court for a stay, and the court would need to grant it.
That's not necessary. We'll stay it. Okay, thank you, Ms. Ferrier.
Thank you. Well, you've helped me to understand a lot of things that,
I hope so.
I may not. I do have one more question. May I?
Of course.
Because I was confused by your jurisdictional argument. The claim that we had no jurisdiction to review the claim because of a matter of discretion whether or not to grant a continuance, because the brief then cited cases where we clearly went ahead and reviewed a refusal to grant a continuance for abuse of discretion. And I'm wondering whether the Attorney General thinks that we were acting outside our jurisdiction in those cases. You know, cases like Castaneda Suarez, Hassan versus.
No, Castaneda Suarez and Hassan were both decided prior to ARERA, the changes in ARERA, which enacted the judicial bar at 240 at INA 242A2B II. That is what we're basing the argument on. In Subhan, if I'm pronouncing that case name correctly, the court considered that bar in regards to a continuance motion. But the court didn't actually decide whether it did or did not have jurisdiction. It assumed that even if we don't have jurisdiction under that bar, that the immigration judge hasn't given us a reason for his denial in the case. In this case, all I've tried to do in my jurisdictional argument is distinguish that Subhan from our case, because the immigration judge did give a reason here. He denied the continuance because an application had not been filed.
Well, what if the reason he had given was that he didn't like the color of the alien's eyes? Would that be unreviewable because he'd given a reason?
I believe that per the suggestions in Subhan, that might be something that would be without, you wouldn't have jurisdiction to review it because it is a reason within his discretion.
That makes no sense, right?
Well, what was suggested in Subhan was that if the immigration judge had said that you need to file an application before your temporary status expires, or you need to you simply stayed too long, or you know, gave some sort of reason justifying his denial and showing that he exercised his discretion, that would be enough.
But the reason would have to be rational, right? It couldn't be completely weird.
Well, it would need to be
right?
A judge.
I don't grant continuances on Friday, right? You couldn't say that. I don't grant continuances when there's a full moon.
Well, within the exercise of his discretion,
that would
be something.
You cannot be
if
serious.
It was,
you
if,
cannot be serious.
If he raises something which rises to the level of a constitutional
error. No, not constitutional. He says, I'm superstitious. I don't grant continuances when the moon is full. And you're saying there's no judicial review of that.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, thank you very much. Look, I hope you will go back to your superiors in the Justice Department and say that we judges in the Seventh Circuit, and I think in other circuits, we don't know what we're dealing with here. Because we're seeing a series of immigration cases, mainly not only asylum cases, in which the behavior of the immigration authorities does not appear to be rational. It's not that we disagree and I think make mistakes or we have warm feelings toward foreigners or anything like that, but in case after case we reverse. A remarkable string of reversals by all the different judges on this court because the behavior of the agency appears to be irrational. And here you're saying that if an immigration judge gives no reason for denying a continuance, that's reviewable. But if he gives a reason which is clearly irrational, then it's unreviewable. And what possible sense could that? How could the law be so nutty as to recognize a distinction of that sort?
I was just trying to, first of all, distinguish the court's decision in Subhan to say that there was a reason here. Secondly, I was only basing my arguments on the law, the statutory provision that under 242A2B II, there would be no jurisdiction to review a discretionary determination. I will definitely make your comments known.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Ferrier. Mr. Mwangi, does he have any time left? No. Okay, well, we'll...
Can we give him a minute? We gave him a minute.
Okay. Do you have anything further you'd like?
No. The judges have some questions.
Do you have questions? I think Judge Rovner has a question.
Yeah, I'm just so worried about this bag and baggage. order. Are you all right with this at this point, or?
Well, Your Honor, I just got it in the last couple of days, and checking with my client, it says C.C. Godfrey Mwangi, cert mail, which suggests it was sent by certified mail, no certified mail number, which is usually...
Well, don't worry about that.
And so,
sorry about the number.
And so I don't know...
What's the date on it?
It
I mean,
says
what's the date that he has to leave?
October 18th.
October. So there's a month.
I'm going to file a motion for a stay, but I haven't had a chance.
Well, that's okay. I can stay it myself.
And so I'm not comfortable with it because it portends terrible things, but I think I can clarify a little bit, you know, in fairness to the government. When Mr. Bensliman went in for special registration, an alien number was created because of that. When he and his wife had filed their one-step packet, that triggered an alien number to be filed. These two alien numbers have files that have been proceeding on separate tracks. Now, his name is not an ordinary name. It's a very unusual name. And what has perplexed me is why these two files have never merged, even though at his first hearing, this was pointed out to the service.
But is this a reference to this visa petition?
That is correct, Judge.
That's pending. But is Ms. Ferrier correct? This is pending somewhere else? And
well, it is pending because no decision denying it has ever been issued that I'm aware of or that my clients are aware of.
Well, how do we know, for instance, how can we know that something will happen with the one alien number and something different will happen with the second alien number? Are you in possession of both files at this point? Is there some way to put these two files together?
Well, getting the bag and baggage all of a sudden is an illustration of the fact that I'm not, because it is as much a surprise to me as it is to you, Your Honor, that all of a sudden, as we prepare to argue this, they want to ship him out.
Well, obviously, it must come from the other file.
That is correct, Judge. And so, before this can happen, I would have expected some kind of decision saying, we've denied the visa petition and the adjustment application. And that's the weird aspect of this, because the predicate to this has not occurred. Now, clearly they have
my
address.
But couldn't they deport or remove someone even while they were considering his visa application?
They can do that, and it has happened
before.
Maybe
that's what they want to do.
I'm not a mind reader, Judge Posner, so I couldn't answer that question.
Are you handling his other number, the visa petition proceeding?
They filed that pro se, and so that is proceeding as they filed it, and to my knowledge, once they put that in the mail, it's almost proceeding automatically, and only God knows where that is. And so nothing has happened that would
involve
me. There
hasn't been a notification from a judge or something, immigration judge?
Where I would get involved is if they were summoned for an interview.
I see. They haven't been summoned for the interview?
They have not.
When was this petition filed?
It was filed January 7 of 2003.
So it's been languishing since January for the last 2.5 years.
January 7 of 2003. One event did occur where an agent of the ICE called Lucas went to their house on April 22nd.
ICE, Immigration?
Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Okay.
Went to their house regarding the investigation of the bona fides of their marriage, which has to do with the I-130 visa petition.
Right.
Now,
right.
That was instigated after or by the district counsel who appeared before the IJ at the February 25, 2003 hearing, who said, we don't know what our position will be. We are going to put this in investigations. Mr. Hagan went back to the IJ on May 27, said, Agent Lucas went to their house, said, everything's okay. When Mr. Harper, the district counsel, said, we're going to investigate it, the IJ ordered a report by May 27. And that's what he got agitated about on May 27, because there was no report regarding the findings of the investigation. And that's where he begins shifting the focus to Mr. Bensley Mann.
And there hasn't been a report yet?
Nobody has seen it. And the next thing that happened was Mr. Bensley Mann got ordered deported because of 485. Now, Ms. Ferrier says the I-485 has information in it which discloses to the IJ a lot of stuff. Well, that's not so. This is a four-page form, which on its fourth page only has a signature. On the third page asks whether he's ever been arrested and that sort of stuff, which after he went for special registration, he was fingerprinted. His whole background was looked into. And so that's the only thing that form would have revealed. So focusing so obsessively on that form is ridiculous.
That's the 485?
That's the I-485. All it does is give him biographic information, and it's a proxy for his prima facie case for adjustment of status. All that information, if you read the record, has been provided to the IJ. Who is his wife? Does he have any kids? That's the information on the I-485. So insisting that that's the crux of the whole case is really bizarre.
And the I-130, does that have more stuff? Or?
That's information about the marriage,
right,
when they started living together, and that's the part the INS looks at to determine if there is a marriage. That is the predicate.
But didn't the IJ want that also?
No, the IJ waits for the approval
one?
Of that.
I see. That comes out of this visa thing.
That is the visa petition. That's the predicate to the authority of the IJ to approve the adjustment or the green card.
Okay, well, actually, that's very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Wong. Yeah, and thank you, Ms. Ferrier. Sorry, I was brutal with you, but, you know, it does reflect the genuine frustration of the judges about the handling of these matters. So...